The Daily Exchange podcast is sponsored by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucettesurvey.com. That's D-O-U-C-E-T survey.com.
Support for the Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Less than 2 weeks after the midterm elections, at least one politician is still on the campaign trail. Texas Governor Rick Perry toured New Hampshire over the weekend, making stops around the state. One theme, foreign policy. Perry said if we want peace, we can't withdraw from the world.
The answer is not to withdraw from threats abroad. We won the Cold War because of a relentless policy of engagement and an unwavering show of resolve. We wore down the enemy.
Meanwhile, New Hampshire's embattled oil company Fred Fuller also made headlines this week when it declared bankruptcy on Monday. James Buffetti from the Attorney General's office assured worried customers his agency is keeping an eye on the situation.
We want to make sure that the people who gave Fred Fuller pre-buy money last winter for this heating season that now begins get some protection and get the oil that they already paid for or get their money back.
And this weekend, the second round for open enrollment under the Affordable Care Act begins. Industry insiders like Tom Porlicelli, CEO of Minuteman Health, advise Granite Staters to get started early.
Waiting till the last minute is a very bad idea because the volumes are going to be very high. It's also going to be harder to find someone who has the time to help you.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Call in The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for this week's Roundup are Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, thanks for being here.
Thanks for inviting me, Laura.
Also with us, Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press. Welcome back, Rick. Good to see you.
Great to be here.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University and author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, good to see you, too. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, and joining us for a few minutes now, gentlemen, is Jack Rodolico. He's NHPR's health and science reporter with an update on the Affordable Care Act, round two for enrollment. And Jack, thanks for taking the time. We appreciate
it. Good to be here, yeah.
So what happens this weekend, Jack?
Open enrollment. So it's round two. So the healthcare.gov is open for business. It has been open for sort of shopping and perusing all week long. But as of tomorrow, you can start purchasing plans. And so this year looks a lot different than last year, because last year we had just one carrier, that was Anthem, offering a couple handfuls of plans. This year there are five insurers offering about 40 plans. And so people will see a lot more options if they're shopping on the exchange this year.
And when you hear, you know, five companies, 40 plans, that doesn't mean, though, Jack, right, that every New Hampshire resident will have access to all of this.
Right. Well, there's a sort of a dichotomy here in that last year, you know, Anthem was criticized for not opening up their network to all the hospitals in the state. This year, all the hospitals are covered by all of the different insurers, but not every plan covers every hospital. So if you're in the Monadnock region, you really need to make sure that you're purchasing a plan that fits the hospitals in your and the doctors in your region. If you're in the North Country, same thing. As you might expect, people in the southern tier of the state have a few more options. People in the north have a few fewer. But there is something out there for everyone at this point.
Well, and when some people, myself included, hear shopping for health insurance, they say, oh, you know, it's so detailed and the language is so difficult to get through and it's hard to figure out. But there's a lot of help from what I understand, Jack.
It's dauntingly confusing when you think about it. I mean, there's 40 different plans and it's, you know, each one costs a little bit different and you have to you really need to think it through. And to be honest, you just need some professional advice. You know, I did a piece that aired this morning. And we sort of tried to tackle this as an advice column because, again, it's a daunting amount of choices. So my recommendation is to the first thing you could do, I mean, get on the website and start looking around, but call a broker. You don't pay a broker. Brokers get paid by the insurance company, and they get paid the same amount no matter which insurance company you go through. So it's really good to put your trust in the broker's hands. It's a very simple appointment, and you can go through the insurance department's website or our website through My Story That's Up to find the link for a list of about 200 brokers around the state. And they call them up, make an appointment, and they will help walk you through the plan that best suits your family. So I would really recommend getting some professional advice. Think about the network, not just the price tag, although the price tag obviously is important. And the other thing that's really important, if you enrolled last year, you have to get back on and enroll again.
Okay.
There's a couple there's about 40,000 people in the state that fit into that category. It's really, really important for those people because, first of all, your financial information may have changed since last year. Maybe you got a raise. Maybe you're making less money now. Your tax subsidy will change. If you don't re-enroll, you're in for a tax headache next year. The other reason is simply that there's more options. So maybe even if you like your plan, you're going to find potentially something that you like better, whether it's with Anthem or one of the other carriers. It doesn't really matter so long as you're happy with the plan.
Well, and one interesting thing that I got from your story, Jack, is you don't have to pay for the broker, $15 a pop, and that doesn't matter whether I buy the top of the line or the bottom of the line. So the broker has no incentive to push me toward a more expensive plan.
Right. So they get paid $15 per enrollee per month. So if you sign up with that broker, they're making $15 per month off of that enrollment through the next year unless you cancel the plan. So if they sign, you know, they can make a little bit of padded income. You know, they're not making tons of money off it, but they are padding their income a little bit. But again, they don't have an incentive to push you one way or another. And the other thing that's really important to keep in mind is just don't wait. It's very confusing. It's very easy to put it off. But it's only 3 months. It's December 15th to February 15th. And if you want coverage January 1st, November 15th to February 15th. And if you want coverage January 1st, you need to sign up by December 15th. So whatever first of the month you want coverage by, you need to sign up 2 weeks prior. And brokers are booking out into December now. So you really need to sort of get on it if you're going to buy a plan through the exchange. And if you are within 400% of the federal poverty line, which most people who signed up last year were, it's really a big incentive to go through the exchange because you're going to get a subsidy.
Okay. Well, Jack's piece, NHPR.org. And Jack, you and I and some other guests are going to talk again on Monday in more detail on this. Thanks a lot for joining us now.
Thank you.
That's Jack Rodolico. Again, he's NHPR's health and science reporter. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477, as we cover the main big stories that made headlines this week in New Hampshire. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Dean, I did want to ask you one quick question about this open enrollment period that Jack described for us. And then we'll move on to a bunch of other stories we have to cover. But how does this dramatic expansion here in New Hampshire that Jack described fit in with the shifting politics surrounding the ACA in Washington?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The focus on the ACA has been eclipsed a little bit politically recently by the focus on immigration and whether or not President Obama is going to issue an executive order and also the increased troop presence in Iraq to deal with the ISIS threat. So it hasn't exactly been on the back burner. On the other hand, it hasn't been in the headlines as much. There's obviously a lot of pressure on the administration to deliver this time with the second enrollment period, given the problems the first time around. Speaker John Boehner has said that Congress will move to repeal the ACA because he says that's what voters want if you look at public opinion. My guess is Mitch McConnell will try as well. We know that the House has voted to repeal Obamacare, I think, several dozen times, maybe as much as 35 or 40 times. The Senate, now that it's in Republican control, it will be a different story in that chamber. So that's a big concern for the Obama administration. Obviously, as long as President Obama is president, he can veto any repeal. The bigger issue, I think, is going to be the Supreme Court case dealing with state exchanges. If you look at the law, it says that you qualify for a subsidy if you get your insurance through a state exchange. It does not explicitly mention national or national-state hybrid. So this is going to go back to court. Democrats say the intent was obvious. Everybody gets a subsidy. Republicans say if you read the text, it does not mention the national exchanges. So I think the Supreme Court case is going to be the bigger potential roadblock for the administration.
And that has an impact, or could have an impact, depending on how the case
on
goes,
the exchanges,
in New
yeah.
Hampshire, because Absolutely. Ours is a hybrid.
Hybrid. We're not a purely state-based exchange, yes.
All right. Again, I want to let everybody know we'll be following up on this more on Monday. But I did want to turn to another business story, Jeff Feingold, the trials and tribulations of the Fred Fuller Oil Company. Just as the weather is starting to get pretty chilly, what's the latest, Jeff?
Well, it's interesting. The problems that Fred Fuller has been going through is they started more than a year ago. If people remember that they had a problem with apparently a communication snafu, which is now in court. They're suing Fairpoint, actually, over it. And they were unable to make deliveries to their customers over a period of many days and weeks. It turns out that they really have not recovered from that. And they ended up filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy.
No, it's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a
very
big deal. And this is a big company. It's the biggest single oil heat dealer in the state. It's about 30,000 customers. What happened, basically, they were basically forced into bankruptcy because of a suit by a very big energy distributor, Sprague Energy, based over there in Portsmouth. And they say that Fred Fuller owes them $4.7 million, which is a lot of money.
Wow.
And, I think what happened is that with those debts, with many more debts, I think the total debt's about $13.5 million. They just went into bankruptcy protection, reorganization. But apparently the goal is to find a buyer, which is interesting because if they're the biggest in the state, so it's going to have to be someone bigger than them. And it narrows the field down, and it's very interesting to think about who possibly would be buying this company.
Well, and Rick Stevens, the Attorney General's office this week, chimed in and said, hey, don't worry, folks, we're keeping an eye on this.
Yeah, Attorney General Foster said that they're aware of the situation. They're advising customers to keep an eye on their tank. Give the company a call right away if it looks like supplies are getting low, and they'll work with them to try and ensure deliveries. The company believes it should be able to get enough financing to maintain supplies and deliveries through the season. And you're right, it's starting to get cold again, so it becomes a relevant issue.
Yeah, that's the important thing to remember. They filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, so they're being reorganized. It's not like they're out of business.
It's not a shutdown.
Which is very important to remember. They're under the protection of the bankruptcy court right now to shield them from their creditors.
Yeah. Well, maybe a little bit later we can talk about just Well, let me ask you now, Jeff. I mean, how does this happen? You know, this is a huge company. It's really important. A lot of people depend on it.
Well, it does raise the questions about the management of the company. One of the other trials and tribulations they've been going through is a series of sexual harassment suits. And it does make you kind of wonder who's running the ship and how it's being run. I don't have definite knowledge of it, but it's more than just a coincidence that it has these other kind of issues involved as well.
All right, well, coming up, we will turn to the State House and several happenings there, including the race for House Speaker. All that coming up on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. And gentlemen, let's turn to the State House and what's been happening there. Post-election politics continues. And Dean Spiliotis, the big talk now at the State House is who's going to be House Speaker. One candidate dropped out this week. What happened?
We know that we're going to find out on Tuesday whether or not, basically, it's all coming down to whether or not we're going to have Bill O'Brien as Speaker again. And he was Speaker from 2010 to 2012. You're hearing two sets of arguments. You're hearing from Democrats, he was an extreme Tea Party Speaker, kind of ruled with a very authoritarian hand in an office that is not typically designed to be run in that fashion. And they point to a number of different policy areas like mental health and state college education and heating oil where there were some cuts in the budget. And they argue Governor Hassan has worked hard to restore those with the current leadership. Republicans say it's a caricature and an overreaction that he actually was just a solid conservative speaker.
In a tough fiscal time and that the budget had to be cut.
Exactly right. So, it has big implications for Governor Hassan, although she has said, she'll work with anybody, and she often touts her bipartisan budget from the last biennium. So, we'll see what happens. I mean, a lot of it's going to kind of depend on the tone that he sets He has said that he has no intention of being conflictual, but we'll wait and see.
Yeah, Rick, go ahead and then Jeff.
Either way, it's going to be back to the future for the House leadership. It's either Bill O'Brien or Gene Chandler in North Country.
We've seen this race before.
We've seen this race before. Just yesterday, Lori Sanborn, who was the third candidate or presumptive candidate for House Speaker, she left the race. Her husband, State Senator Andy Sanborn, had a health scare last week, so she's decided to focus on her family. That was sort of an interesting dynamic because it was the past. It was O'Brien and it was Chandler, and then there was Sanborn, and she presented herself as the fresh face, the new leadership to try and move things forward. So either way, either Gene Chandler or Bill O'Brien will be running the House.
Yeah, and Jeff, go ahead, and then I have another question.
Yeah, something interesting to note that at the first time I can remember that many Republicans, high-level Republicans like Senator Ayotte,
that's what I wanted to ask you about,
have chimed in on this and have urged the House Republican caucus to support Gene Chandler.
So in your long time watching New Hampshire politics, you've not seen that before.
I can't remember anything like this. I've seen it happen in political races, but this is something I can't remember. And it seems as if actually like the line is being drawn here in terms of who's going to be in charge of this? It kind of is reminiscent of a few years ago when there was a battle between who was going to be the chairman of the Republican Party, and it ended up being Jack Kimball for a time, who was a Tea Party candidate, and the then chairman, Governor Sununu, was stepping down, and he supported another candidate. So there was a kind of a battle there, and the Tea Party wing won on that one. And it'll be interesting, really interesting, to see what happens, how the caucus comes down on this one, because they're getting the message from their, the mainstream Republicans, please don't elect Bill O'Brien again. I think they have concerns about the election in 2016.
So that's interesting. So just to let folks know who may not have heard the story this morning. So big cheeses, establishment cheeses, if we could call them that, Kelly Ayotte, John Sununu, Charlie Bass, the former U.S. representative from the 2nd District, they sent a letter to House Republicans saying, we like Gene Chandler.
Endorsing Gene Chandler specifically, just looking at it as an observer, it's like waving a red flag against the more conservative Tea Party wing of the party, because there's no love lost between them, and certainly between Governor Sununu and Charlie Bass, and I think actually Senator Ayotte as well.
Well, here's a question for you, Dean Spiliotis. During the election for U.S. Senate and U.S. House, we kept hearing, how powerful John Boehner was, the Speaker of the House, or how powerful Harry Reid was, the head of the Senate. Is it the same in the New Hampshire legislature? My understanding is that these positions aren't nearly as powerful. Well, they don't matter as much.
Right. I think that's – in general, that's a true statement. I think part of the issue with Bill O'Brien was he either tried or did make a number of changes that kind of moved it more in the direction of kind of a hierarchical sort of governing from the top type of organization. It is a very big body, 400 legislators. It can be very unruly and difficult to reach policy consensus. The biggest concern for these individuals who wrote the letter was that it'd be a very convenient target for Democrats in 2016. I mean, you even heard it from Governor Hassan this time around, that she's still trying to undo the Bill O'Brien legislature, and she doesn't want to return to that. So it's a very convenient kind of political target for Democrats.
I just want to circle back, too, to the political notion that Jeff talked about with Senator Ayotte. Sort of, she's become, she is, the de facto top of the GOP party in the state now. And you saw the O'Brien politics in this campaign. I hate to bring it all back to politics every time, but that's what's happening already. They're already starting to look forward to 2016. They're, Governor Hassan has been at least floated as a potential Senate candidate.
Well, and actually, if you want to talk about 2016, that's when Senator Ayotte is up for re-election, and I think she has concerns about what's going to happen, because if you look back to 2010, there was a big Republican wave, and that's when Bill O'Brien had his first term as Speaker. 2012. There was just as much of a wave of Democrats taking over, and it's interesting to see what's been how the Democrats, I think, while they would probably work with someone else besides Bill O'Brien, I think they probably wouldn't mind if he were the Speaker.
And he's handy for them to run against.
Absolutely. He was an issue in this past campaign.
All right. You can join us again. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're catching up on some of the major stories of the week. We'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. And gentlemen, I did want to ask you about one more political story. One of you mentioned 2016, and Rick Stevens, Rick Perry was here
this week.
Speaking of 2016, what was his visit like? Sometimes there's a theme or an approach that these candidates try and take.
The approach actually was very familiar to what we heard during the immediate aftermath of the election a couple of weeks ago, where Republicans said, "Hey, this election wasn't saying we love you, Republicans." It was, we got to do things differently in Washington. So that was the pardon me, that message that Perry was preaching. It's interesting. He was here a couple of times before the midterm, and then he's the first guy out of the gate after the midterm. He's here 5 days after the election, and yet he has this sort of – and I'll let Dean speak a little more to this, but he says he's not going to make a decision for another, 7 months, not till May, which I know we're only at the end of 2014, but guess what? The clock is ticking on the primary already.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, if you look back to 2004 and 2008, most of the candidates set up their exploratory committees as early as December of 2 years before the election, and then more typically January, February of the year before the election to get ready for the Iowa caucus and New Hampshire primary. So we saw in the last cycle in 2012, a number of the Republicans waited until April, May. I think even Donald Trump jumped out of the race in June. So it was interesting to hear, you know, Perry on the one hand is so eager to kind of have a second chance at New England because he had a very rough campaign here the last time. But then he says he's going to wait till May, which has just struck me as a little odd. But, you know, maybe the cycle will be delayed again, but I wouldn't be surprised to see some people jumping in again in February and March.
But actually, if he is laying the groundwork for a campaign and he is making a big deal about this second chance because he really stumbled badly in New Hampshire last time, I don't know why he would want to wait till May. I mean, I would think he'd want to just get out of the box right away and start saying, "Here I am. I love New Hampshire," and, you know, pull a Joe Lieberman, maybe move here for a few months or whatever.
Well, it didn't work out so well.
Didn't work that well for Senator Lieberman. No.
I do remember that, though. He rented an apartment in Manchester.
That's right.
The number here in the exchange for the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup as we catch up on some of the big stories of the week, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We want some of the stories that caught your attention this week. What made you sit up and take notice that you heard on the news or read in the paper or online? 1-800-892-6477, again, is the number for you to join the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. One more story from the State House, gentlemen, and I think I'll start with you, Rick Stevens. The Site Evaluation Committee, Governor Maggie Hassan withdrew two names of high-profile folks that she had submitted earlier. A couple questions. First of all, what is the Site Evaluation Committee? Why is it so important?
Oh, especially this time around with energy rising to the fore in the state. The Site Evaluation Committee is the one that gives the approval, the thumbs up or the thumbs down to these projects, any wind projects, transmission lines, any pipeline expansion, think Northern Pass. That's one of the big gorilla in the room right now. So Governor Hassan had nominated Bob O'Dell, former state senator, and Amanda Merrill. And both she had to withdraw both of those after getting some pretty strong criticism from lawmakers who have to approve those nominations. So she has nominated Patricia Weathersby of Rye and Roger Hawk of Concord. Weathersby is a lawyer, and Hawk owns a planning company. So she's nominated those two folks. This is an important body. They can really shape the way the state looks and its energy policies in the future.
It's interesting because it sounds so, I hate to say it, Dean, but so sort of, bureaucratic and small, Site Evaluation Committee. But Rick's absolutely right. From pipelines to wind towers to hydropower projects, this committee is where it's at.
Yeah, there really is a lot at stake. We've talked a number of times on the roundup about the evolution of energy policy in the state, and we've talked about spiking heating prices due to capacity problems with natural gas in the state. And so this site committee is going to be at the center of a number of big issues. Any kind of big wind projects, we've talked about those in the past. The site committee the site evaluation committee is important. Northern Pass. It seems kind of, a little obscure and bureaucratic, but it really has become a focal point of really advocacy groups on both sides of whatever energy issue we're talking about. And in fact, some of the wind groups were quite vocal about the initial nominations, and that was sort of the impetus to rethink it. And you know, now you have, and so you know, now Governor Hassan sort of made what is, in essence, a political move. But I don't think she really saw any other choice.
Yeah, I agree with you. What Dean was saying, actually. The interesting thing about the Site Evaluation Committee at this point is that it's become much more high profile in the last couple of years, especially because of Northern Pass, but in particular because of these wind projects, because there's been a lot of vocal opposition to them. And Senator O'Dell, who now lives in New London but used to live in Leominster, was a supporter of a wind farm that is in Leominster. It was actually, I think, was the first wind farm ever built in New Hampshire.
So wind opponents thought he would be
supportive of it. But the other point is that energy, as Rick said, is an extremely important issue in New Hampshire,
and becoming more and more important.
And the idea that it's going that the Site Evaluation Committee might become this political battleground is a little concerning to some people, because these are issues that need to be addressed relatively quickly and make decisions. You know, let's go, move on, move off, whatever. And that's a concern, I think, to a lot of people who are watching this.
Well, when you travel to other states, you do see these projects. You know, I've said on this show before, Vermont seems to have a ton of solar. Out west, yeah, there's wind turbines everywhere. It's just interesting. Other states seem to be moving forward more quickly than New Hampshire, and I do wonder about the politics
and
of this.
And New Hampshire has a very serious situation when it comes to its energy. We've talked about it on this show many times. You know, we're relying on one source of energy, natural gas for the most part.
And we have the pipeline capacity
problems.
Yes,
exactly. And there's a need for other alternatives, renewable energy, and the discussion is not won't be moving forward as quickly as people would like to see. Many people would like to see.
No, quickly won't be a word that you hear. As a matter of fact, they revamped the SEC last year, and now instead of a 9-month review period, it's a 12-month review period. I reported last week that Northern Pass, on an investors' call, said that they hope to have a plan that everybody can at least agree to review by the middle of 2015. Remember, this was supposed to be a transmission project online by 2017. Yeah. Now they're talking 2018, the end of 2018. So it's rolling out, and we still face these energy pinches.
Absolutely.
Again, our phone number here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We want your thoughts on some of the top news stories that we're talking about, from issues surrounding energy in the Granite State and the Site Evaluation Committee to some of the politicking at the State House, the race for House Speaker, who will hold leadership positions in Concord this year. And toward that end, we got an email from Christopher in Manchester, who says, I'm wondering where your guests think most of the votes of the folks who were ready to support Lori Sanborn will go. Will Chandler benefit more than O'Brien? Dean Spiliotis, what do you think? It's a good question.
I'll take a guess. You know, Lori Sanborn, if my recollection serves me, kind of came out of the Tea Party ethos when she first ran for the House. So my sense is she's conservative, comes out of the Tea Party wing, probably has more of an affinity with Bill O'Brien. I don't know if you would call him a mentor or not, but I think certainly she's from that wing of the party. And so that would be my assumption, that they would back Bill O'Brien, but I'm just speculating based on my kind of knowledge of her as a politician. The difference between Gene Chandler and Bill O'Brien is kind of sort of just stylistic, but there also is sort of some policy difference as well in terms of sort of Tea Party versus establishment.
Let's take a call. Thanks for that email, Christopher. And we will find out next week. So listen to the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup next week to find out who won and why. Let's take a call, gentlemen. This is Marcy in Nashua. Hi, Marcy. You're on the Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Laura. I'm sorry I didn't get the names of your guests there.
That's all right, Marcy. Go ahead.
Now, you may think I'm crazy, but now that the Senate and the House of Representatives are both held by Republicans, I think that the Republicans will try to put out some bills that they know will be vetoed by the president. So the president looks bad. Then they'll bring out some bills which are absolutely probably going to pass in both houses, and the president will sign them too, because he's got the backing of the Senate. So that way the bill gets through. So either way, the president looks bad and the Republicans look good.
Okay. Well, Marcy, thanks for the call. And sorry to jump in on you there. Dean, she's commenting more on national politics. We try to stick more to New Hampshire here, but I just wonder if you have any thoughts on
that. Yeah, just briefly. I mean, there's certainly one possible scenario. It's amazing when you hear the two sides talk about how they think kind of the strategic interaction is going to play out. You know, it is true that the House of Representatives in the last session passed a large number of bills that just basically went nowhere in the Senate because Harry Reid sat on them. Now that the Republicans are in the majority in the Senate, there certainly is a possibility that there will be a number of bills that will go through that President Obama will certainly veto. They may find common ground on a few things like trade. We don't know what he's going to do in the Keystone Pipeline. That's moving very quickly through Congress as well. So, you know, I think both sides will try to use it to their advantage in 2016. You know, President Obama and Democrats will say that, you know, they basically had to veto this legislation to protect the country. And Republicans will say that President Obama was obstructionist. It's just kind of a continuation of where we've been, really.
I just want to say one thing. This question from Marcy raises an interesting point. The president, because he is facing facing Republican majorities in both the House and the Senate, will have to reach out certainly to some Republican senators. And apparently he's looking for people Republican senators who will be running for re-election in 2016, who come from states that have elected him at least once, if not twice. And lo and behold, that question is that is New Hampshire, and that's Senator Ayotte, who's up for election. And apparently they're going to be working on Senator Ayotte as, you know, maybe some kind of someone who they can compromise with and work with.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's something to keep an eye on.
So that's a New Hampshire take on Marcy's question, is that the Republican Party may be sort of grooming Senator Ayotte, putting her in positions to present acceptable bills so she can be seen as a bipartisan compromiser and
she's up for re-election in what is essentially, you know, as we've seen in this last election, is a pretty blue state at this point. And it's
depending on which level you look at.
Well, if you look at the national, if you're looking at the statewide races, I mean, that really.
And the 2016 race in the U.S. Senate is going to be in blue territory this time, not on red the way it was
just
last election.
Exactly.
Well, real quickly, this week there was a journalist who was in the news, James Pindle from WMUR Television. And Rick Stevens, there's been no sight of Mr. Pindle recently on TV or anywhere.
No, to back up, this dates to the last debate between Scott Brown and Senator Gene Shaheen, where there was a disagreement over geography, the location of Sullivan County compared to Concord. And James Pindle, one of the debate moderators, panelists rather, he corrected candidate Brown, later apologized on the air. And there's been a lot of activity in the blogs and in the Twitterverse about where has James been. I think it just points out that the real challenge that anybody faces when you're moderating a debate, you just have to, you know, there's a lot of people watching and there's an awful lot at stake.
All right. Well, we will talk about that a little bit more after break. Also, what the Associated Press has found out about the Abigail Hernandez case. All that coming up on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. And gentlemen, let's return to the story we were talking about just before the break. And Dean Spiliotis, Rick Stevens set it up for us, talking about James Pindle, the WMUR reporter, well-respected lead political reporter here in the state, all of a sudden not being heard from. There's even a hashtag, I think, Where's James? Yeah. What's your take on this, Dean?
Well, you know, we have not heard anything from MUR, but it's pretty clear he's on some sort of indefinite suspension. They've taken him off the air. I don't know what the nature of their relationship will be going forward. You know, the bigger issue here is it just shows you how much is at stake. We've got 2016 coming up. There are going to be presidential debates in the state before New Hampshire. MUR, I'm sure, wants to be very careful to present itself as an unbiased forum for these debates. It was interesting after that whole brouhaha over the question, progressives were sort of heartened by Brown being kind of knocked back on his heels a little bit. But, you know, the reality is, you know, James took a beating in the national media the next day about, you know, just sort of bias and that it was unnecessary and unfair. And I'm sure that's not the kind of press that MUR wants as they go into the negotiating season for the presidential debate. So he basically vanished from the air a day or two before Election Day.
Yeah, I think one of the most concerning things about this issue is that WMUR has been really silent on this and not explaining what's going on. And, you know, as a company in the media, you'd think that they would at least put out a statement saying something, but they have basically at this point refused to just say anything about what happened to James. And the other thing I have to say is as Dean said, he was, you know, James was beaten up by, you know, certain people in the media over that question. But if you think, if you look back at that question, the question was about the Sullivan County economy. And Scott Brown did not answer the question about the Sullivan County economy. And somehow it morphed into geography lesson. That was the spin, but it was obvious that Mr. Brown really didn't know anything about the Sullivan County economy. He was giving a boilerplate answer to some of the other things, and that was a concern. But the reaction by WMUR apparently was, you know, right. I would be interested to know if one of the other reporters on the panel had asked the same question who was not an employee of WMUR, what would have happened?
Yeah, I think the unfortunate thing for James was, I think that, as you said, Scott Brown's kind of vague non-answer should have just been left to stand for itself. It was pretty clear he didn't really know about Claremont or Newport or any of the key economic issues in that part of Sullivan County. Should have just let the kind of vagueness of the answer stand for itself to kind of remind people that he'd only been in the state for roughly a year. But it was the kind of going back again and again that he got criticized for.
Well, and here's something from the column by our colleague Dan Tuohy at the Union Leader. He says WMUR has not commented on the personnel issue. Pindle continues to write a story for the New Hampshire Sunday News. And so Dan Tuohy says, look for the backstory column this Sunday. So I think
wonder
if
the backstory will be about this debate.
what will the backstory be about? You know, speaking of media companies, Rick Stevens, an old family-owned newspaper dating from, almost 150 years ago, established by a family, Foster's Daily Democrat, is being sold, entering a new era. What's going on?
Foster's Daily Democrat, 143-year-old family-owned newspaper. There still are family-owned papers out there. And they announced this week that they'll be sold to Portsmouth-based Seacoast Media. That's the publisher of the Portsmouth Herald. Look, this has gone on in a lot of places around the country where smaller papers have been fighting the good fight against a rising tide against the media business environment. So what they see is perhaps some economies of scale. They can combine some of the operations, their own operations, with that of Portsmouth. It was encouraging to see Patty Foster, who's the current president and publisher of the paper, say everybody at Foster's is going to be offered a position. Now, I don't know what that means in terms of will they all keep those positions? Will they be the same positions they're in now? But it seems like what they want to do is really firm up that footprint down in the Seacoast area, the southeastern part of the state.
Well, I wonder if folks on the Seacoast feel a little bit better that at least it was bought up by a well-known media company, Seacoast Media Group. It's not some big out-of-state buyer that nobody knows.
Yeah, it's a hometown buyer, yeah.
Well, Seacoast Media Group, as far as I know, is owned by Gatehouse Media, isn't it? I mean, isn't it owned by a much larger company? And I think that's something that's been going on in this marketplace for a long time. It's the newspapers have been struggling, and we've seen it happen in New Hampshire many times.
Well, you would know. You're in the business. I'd love your thoughts, Jeff, on how this fits into the broader print picture. Yeah. I mean, you've been at New Hampshire Business Review since I've known you.
Yeah, and it's really, I've been in newspapers since the beginning, and It's been watching a long decline in readership. You know, it's mostly basically aging readers, and I think what happened was newspapers just didn't adapt to going online well enough, and they just made some big mistakes. You know, putting content out for free is, and now you're going to pay for it and all this stuff, and it's very difficult. It's very difficult to bounce back from that, and I think Foster's is an example because that was once one of the more healthy papers in the state. It was a big paper, had a good footprint. They actually even owned other news. They used to own the Laconia Citizen. They were doing so well. They were one of the first to start a Sunday paper. It's in general, it's not necessarily a good sign. It's fine for the people who have their jobs at Foster's. They're supposedly going to keep them, but for the long term, it's not a good sign when newspaper ownership is consolidated, certainly, and also when it's, you know, it just seems like we're dwindling in number and circulation.
Well, family owned
not
for
the business
150
review.
Years. It's impressive. I did want to ask you, back to you, Rick Stevens, but get thoughts from others, that the Associated Press, your organization, has been looking at the Abigail Hernandez case, staying on this case even though it's kind of fallen out of the headlines. Again, just to remind everybody, this is the terrifying story of a teenage girl in the North Country missing 9 months, apparently kidnapped, but to everyone's huge relief, came home a couple months ago. As I said, Rick, the AP has been trying to find out more about this case. What's the latest?
It's been striking because of the dearth of information, just a complete lack of any details coming out of the Attorney General's office, any of the law enforcement agencies. Very quickly, Nathaniel Kibbe has been charged with kidnapping Abigail Hernandez. She returned over the summer to her home under as mysterious circumstances as she disappeared in. So our law enforcement reporter, Lynn Tuohy, filed a motion with the court to unseal the arrest warrant affidavits. These tend to give you the good details about why they've focused in on a certain suspect and what led to the arrest and the charges. Because 4 months has gone by without any details, still no indictment of Nathaniel Kibbe. We're still awaiting that. So it was half a loaf. We got the documents this week, but they were heavily blacked out, very few details. What we did learn is that she waited, after returning home this summer, she waited a week before identifying Nathaniel Kibbe to authorities. We don't know why that delay. We learned that she discovered his name from a cookbook that he gave her that had his name written on it. We learned some other details about the description of the trailer and the house. But there are still far more questions unanswered than there are answered. And when these documents were released earlier this week, public defender Jesse Friedman, no comment from him. Assistant Attorney General Jane Young, she would just let the documents speak for themselves, which, again, were very scarce in terms of any evidence at all.
So, Rick, how do you balance the public's desire to know about this case with the need to protect this girl, her ability to heal, to be normal, to move on? I mean, she's young. I think she's 15 now. I think she was 14
That's a great question.
Taken away. And you have a daughter. I know you're sensitive to this.
Yeah, she was 14. She's 15, turned 15 a week after she disappeared last October. And it is. It's a difficult question that media operations answer every day, and not just high-profile cases, but all sorts of crime cases. You know, we have a very established set of standards regarding identifying victims if we think they may be victims of sexual abuse. If they may be victims of a crime, there's a different standard in this case. Now, one of the things that sets this apart is the very high national profile of this disappearance. Abby Hernandez's face was on billboards and posters. She came out, her mother came out publicly during her disappearance. Abby herself came out publicly afterwards. She went to the local paper in Conway. So that sort of changes the equation a little bit. But you're right. And that's also why prosecutors will redact some of this information, is to protect the victim.
Yeah, well, there's an instance where a local newspaper played a huge role, actually, and the Hernandez family thanked the North Conway paper for the role that it played in keeping the community engaged and helping to bring Abby back. Did you want to jump in, Dean?
Yeah, it's interesting to me. I've been trying to think of another case where we've known so little after so long, given the high profile of the story. You know, just basic things like did she know him through social media and they got together and he wouldn't let her leave, or did he literally snatch her off the street? I mean, these are sort of basic questions that I think are important for kind of the public safety and the public interest that, for whatever reason, we're not privy to. Maybe we will be at some point. But it's just remarkable how long this is dragged on with so little information, and the 1 week to reveal the abductor to the police, you know, just sort of another interesting complicating factor.
Well, again, the phone number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Just very quickly to follow up, you were right, Jeff Feingold. Seacoast Media is owned or managed by Gatehouse Media, based not in New Hampshire, in Middletown, New York. So you're right about that.
Of course I was right.
I did want to ask you guys about, we talked about moose hunting, I think, last week on the show. Jeff, deer hunting season begins this week. How big a deal is this?
Well, deer hunting season is a big deal. It might not be as big a deal as it had been, 20 years or so ago, but it's still a big deal. It still is very important for certain parts of the state's economy, especially up in the North Country, where they obviously want as many visitors as they possibly can. It seems to be there was a story in the National Telegraph by Dave Brooks mentioned that there has been an increase in the last year or so in the number of deer hunting licenses, even though it's still about 20,000 fewer than 20 years ago.
Yeah, so a slight increase in recent years.
But it's a slight increase. Well, that includes resident and non-resident, so we don't know what it is. But in terms of the amount of money it brings in a sizable amount of money, just in terms of people when they come up here, especially non-residents who come up to hunt in New Hampshire. They're here for more than you know, half an hour. So they need places to stay. They need to have, you know, places to eat and all that. So it is an economic engine. It's part of the tourist economy of New Hampshire. It's an important part.
Yeah, go ahead, Rick.
It's also a generational thing. It's a cultural thing. The hunt, fathers to sons, and the state recognizes that. They've expanded their outreach efforts to younger hunters. They do a special youth hunting weekend every year. They have increased classes for younger hunters. The state does interesting things too. They allow you can donate your part of your kill to local food banks, both moose and deer. So you can there's ways to increase the profile, raise the profile of hunters and hunting in the state.
Well, and gentlemen, I want to add on a sober note. James Foley, the slain journalist from Rochester, New Hampshire, was honored this week. His parents were there. It was the big First Amendment award ceremony. Obviously, a sober event this time around. I've been to these events. Sometimes it's more of a celebration. This time, obviously, it was a sad event, but obviously James Foley was worth the award. Just remind us, if you could, Dean Spiliotis, the importance of James Foley here in New Hampshire. We heard a lot about him, not only with the terrible tragedy that he suffered dying at the hands of ISIS, but then it became part of the politics of this year.
Hey, you know, absolutely. I mean, he's obviously one of a number of journalists who have either risked or sacrificed their lives to bring these stories to us internationally so that, you know, the world can see what's going on in places like Syria and Iraq and elsewhere. It became part of the discussion in this election, and not only because of his bravery, but also just because of the larger issue of ISIS and international security and how to stem what seems to be a growing threat of terrorism, both internationally and abroad. We've kind of come back around now, and it sort of gets folded into the whole debate about how interventionist versus isolationist we should be to deal with this particular international threat. So he, in some sense, kind of became a little bit of a standard bearer for that. And you know, there was this sort of subplot about how the government dealt with his parents while he was in captivity and whether or not you should pay ransom. And it's a complicated issue, but it sort of partially at least folded into this larger question of, you know, what should our role in the world be now, given what seems to be a rebounding threat in the Middle East?
Yeah, Rick, go ahead.
You know, the notion of James Foley as a standard bearer is a good one too, Dean. The theme that emerges whenever you talk to anybody about James Foley was his real true desire, his passion. They even use the word calling almost in a religious sense, that he wanted to tell those stories. He didn't want to go cover – he wasn't a war journalist. He wanted to cover the people affected by conflict and by war. Good standard bearer, but he's not alone. I think the award was very well placed for James Foley, but I think the Committee to Protect Journalists has declared this has been the most dangerous year for journalism on record. The Associated Press lost a phenomenal photographer, Anya Nidringhaus, in Afghanistan.
I remember that. Yeah.
And certainly Stephen Sotloff, another journalist with connections to New Hampshire, has been killed by this ISIS group. So it is. It's a dangerous world for journalists, and I think honoring James Foley was a very wise step.
Yeah, I mean, journalists don't always get the best press, but The men and women who work to tell us what's going on around, especially in the most difficult parts of the world, it's really just we owe so much to them. We really do.
All right. Well, all of you, I did want to follow up with what we're talking about next week on The Exchange, give folks a taste of what we'll be looking at on the show, and then ask you guys what you might be following up on next week. We will be looking at, as I said, the Affordable Care Act with the part two for healthcare.gov. Jack Rodolico will be back with us. We'll look at that. Also, Jarl Mohn will be with us. He's the new president and CEO at National Public Radio. He's coming to the state to do an event with us here at NHPR. So we'll sit down with him on Tuesday and just find out how NPR works and what some of that organization's plans are for the future, including protecting NPR's many foreign journalists out in the field. How about you, Jeff Feingold? What are you working on?
Well, the big thing is this week is the selection of the speaker of
big story on Tuesday,
there, which is a big deal. I mean, that's going to set the tone for the next 2 years. So it'll be interesting to see what the outcome is.
Yeah, Rick, how about you?
Well, we'll track some of the State House stuff. The budget is starting to come together. The presentations are being made. But we've got a really fascinating story about a parental abduction case or custodial interference case from 10 years ago that touched New Hampshire. It also touches Colorado, California, Central America, South America. So 10 years ago, this young lady disappeared with her mother, and our Kathy McCormick will have a very nice story revisiting where that is now. And there may be some motion. There may actually be some breaking news with that.
Okay, interesting stuff. Dean, how about you?
Obviously, the speakership selection is going to be the big story. Not surprising to hear that I'm already talking with people in both parties about 2016 and what the race looks like here. That's off and running. Nationally, we're going to see what President Obama does with immigration and this executive order.
And how New Hampshire's delegation votes,
obviously. So a couple of interesting national stories as well.
Okay. Gentlemen, all of you, thank you very much for being here. Dean Spiliotis, thanks as always. Really appreciate it.
Sure. My pleasure, Laura.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University. He's author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. Jeff Feingold, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Great seeing you, Laura.
Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. And Rick Stevens, thanks as always. We appreciate
it. Great to be here.
Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producer is Faith Meixel. Our intern is Joanna Albertson-Grove. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.